As for the population of the Scythians, I was not able to learn it with any accuracy, but I heard differing accounts about their number. Some say they are very many, others that there are few real Scythians. This much, however, they showed me for myself to see. Between the river Borysthenes and the Hypanes, there is a place called Exampius, which I noted just before this, saying it holds a spring of bitter water, and the water flowing from it renders the Hypanes undrinkable. At this location stands a bronze vessel, its size 6 times that of the mixing bowl standing at the mouth of the Pontus, dedicated there by Pausanias, son of Cleombrotus. For any reader who has not laid eyes on it, here is my description. The Scythian bronze vessel easily holds 600 amphorae, and this Scythian vessel is 6 fingers thick. The locals told me it was made from arrowheads. For their king, whose name was Arientes, wishing to know the number of the Scythians, ordered every Scythian to bring him 1 arrowhead from his arrows, on pain of death for anyone who did not bring one. A great quantity of arrowheads was brought together, and he decided to make from them a memorial and leave it behind. From these, then, he made this bronze vessel and dedicated it at this place, Exampius. This is what I heard concerning the number of the Scythians. This land has no marvels except that it has by far the largest rivers and the most numerous. But what is worthy of note, besides the rivers and the great size of the plain, I will now tell. They show a footprint of Heracles imprinted in rock, which resembles the tread of a man, but is 2 cubits in size, beside the river Tiris. This, then, is what it is. I will now go back to the account I set out to tell at the start. While Darius was preparing against the Scythians and sending messengers to instruct some to provide an infantry army, others ships, and others to bridge the Thracian Bosporus, Artabanus son of Hystaspes, who was Darius's brother, urged him by no means to make this campaign against the Scythians, listing the difficulties of dealing with the Scythians. But since he did not persuade him with his good advice, he gave up, and Darius, once everything had been prepared for him, led out his army from Susa. There Oabazus, a Persian, having 3 sons all of whom were on campaign, begged Darius that one of them be left behind for him. Darius said that since he was a friend and was asking for something reasonable, he would leave behind all his sons. Oabazus was overjoyed, hoping that his sons had been released from the campaign, but Darius ordered the men in charge of them to kill all the sons of Oabazus. And these men had their throats cut and were left lying there. Darius, once his journey from Susa brought him to the Bosporus on the Chalcedonian shore where the bridge stood, boarded a vessel there and sailed toward the rocks called Cyanean, which the Greeks claim used to wander before. Taking a seat on a headland, he gazed upon the Pontus, a spectacle worth beholding. Among all seas, it stands out as the most astonishing. Its length is 11,100 stadia, and its breadth, at its widest point, is 3,300 stadia. The mouth of this sea is 4 stadia wide, and the length of the narrow strait at the mouth, which is called the Bosporus, over which the bridge had been built, is 120 stadia. The Bosporus extends into the Propontis, and the Propontis, being 500 stadia wide and 1,400 long, empties into the Hellespont, which is 7 stadia across at its narrowest and 400 long. The Hellespont opens out into the expanse of sea called the Aegean. These measurements were made as follows. A ship, on average, covers about 70,000 fathoms in a long day and 60,000 by night. Now the voyage from the mouth of the Pontus to the Phases, for that is the longest stretch of the Pontus, is 9 days and 8 nights. This comes to 111 myriads of fathoms, and from these fathoms the stadia amount to 11,100. And to Themyscira on the river Thermodon from Sindus, for that is the widest stretch of the Pontus, comes to a crossing lasting 2 nights and 3 days, equal to 33 myriads of fathoms, or 3,300 stadia. So this Pontus, along with the Bosporus and the Hellespont, has now been measured out by me and shown to have the dimensions stated. This Pontus, moreover, feeds a lake that drains into it, one only slightly smaller than itself, which is called the Mietes, and is called the mother of the Pontus. Darius, when he had viewed the Pontus, sailed back to the bridge, whose builder was Mandrakles the Samian. And having viewed the Bosporus too, he set up 2 pillars there of white stone, engraving on them letters, on the one Assyrian, on the other Greek, with all the peoples he was leading, for he led all the nations he commanded. Apart from the fleet, These were counted at 700,000 men, including cavalry, and 600 ships were gathered together. As for these pillars, the Byzantines later carried them into their city and put them to use at the altar of Artemis or Thoja, all except a single stone. That stone was left standing by the temple of Dionysus at Byzantium, covered in Assyrian writing. Now the district by the Bosporus where King Darius bridged it is, as I judge by reckoning, midway between Byzantium and the sanctuary at the mouth of the strait. Darius, afterward being pleased with the floating bridge, rewarded its builder, Mandrakles the Samian, with a gift of everything tenfold. And from this, Mandrakles had a picture painted as a first offering, showing the whole bridging of the Bosporus, and King Darius seated on his throne, and his army crossing it. He had this scene painted and set up as an offering in the Harium, with the following inscription. Having spanned the fish-rich Bosporus with a bridge, Mandrakles dedicated to Hera this memorial of the floating crossing, winning himself a crown and glory for the Samians, having fulfilled the wishes of King Darius. These, then, were the memorials of the bridge's builder. After rewarding Mandrakles, Darius crossed over into Europe, instructing the Ionians to sail up into the Pontus as far as the river Ister. Once they arrived at the Ister, they were to wait there for him, spanning the river with a bridge. The fleet itself was manned by Ionians, Aeolians, and Hellespontines. This fleet passed through the Cyanean rocks and headed directly for the Ister. Then, having rowed upstream for 2 days' distance from the sea, they bridged the river at its narrow neck, the point where the mouths of the Ister branch off. Darius, when he had crossed the Bosporus by the floating bridge, marched through Thrace, and coming to the springs of the river Taurus, he encamped there for 3 days. Now the Taurus is said by those who dwell around it to be the best of rivers, both for its other healing properties, and especially for curing scab in men and horses. Its springs are 38 springs in all, pouring out of the same rock face, some of them cold and some hot. The distance to reach them is equal whether one starts from the city of Harium near Perinthus or from Apollonia on the Euxine Sea, a 2-day trip either way. This Taurus flows out into the river Cantadestus, and the Cantadestus into the Agrians, and the Agrians into the Hebrus, and the Hebrus flows into the sea near the town of Enos. Darius, upon reaching this river and setting up camp, was so taken with it that he erected a pillar there too, inscribed with these words. The headwaters of the river Taurus supply water finer and better than any other river, and to these headwaters came, marching an army against the Scythians, a man who is the best and finest of all men, Darius son of Hystaspes, king of the Persians and of the whole mainland. This is what was written there. Darius, setting out from there, came to another river named the Artescus, which flows through the land of the Odrysi. Having come to this river, he did the following. Marking out a place for the army, he ordered every man, as he passed by, to set down one stone at this marked out place. When the army had done this, he left behind great mounds of stones there and marched the army onward. Before reaching the Ister, he first subdued the Getae, who believed themselves immortal. For the Thracians who hold Salmydessus and dwell above the cities of Apollonia and Mesembria, called the Ciamiani and the Nipsi, surrendered themselves to Darius without a fight. But the Getae, turning to folly, were at once enslaved, though they are the bravest and most just of the Thracians. They believe themselves immortal in this way. They do not think that they die, but that the one who perishes goes to the god Salmoxis, and some of them call this same god Jebelizes. Every 4 years they send one of their number, chosen by lot, as a messenger to Salmoxis, instructing him in whatever they need at each occasion. And they send him in this way. Some of them, appointed for the task, hold 3 javelins, while others, taking hold of the hands and feet of the man being sent to Salmoxis, swing him up into the air and throw him onto the spear points. If he dies pierced through, they believe the god is gracious to them, but if he does not die, they blame the messenger himself, saying that the man is bad, and after leveling that charge they send off someone new. They deliver these instructions to him while he still lives. These same Thracians, whenever thunder and lightning strike, shoot arrows upward toward the sky in defiance of the god, since they recognize no god except their own. According to what I gather from the Greeks living along the Hellespont and the Pontus, this Salmoxis, who was once a man, lived as a slave on Samos, owned by Pythagoras son of Nesarchus. After gaining his freedom there, he built up considerable wealth, and once wealthy, he traveled back to his homeland. Given how harsh and rather unsophisticated Thracian life was, this Salmoxis, familiar with Ionian customs and with ways of thinking more profound than the Thracians knew, having mixed with Greeks and with Pythagoras, no minor intellect among the Greeks, had a men's hall built, in which he received the leading men of the city and entertained them, teaching them that neither he nor his fellow drinkers nor their descendants forever would die, but would come to a place where, living on forever, they would have all good things. While he was doing and saying these things, he was at the same time building an underground chamber. When the chamber stood entirely complete, he vanished from among the Thracians, descending into the underground room where he dwelt for 3 years. Meanwhile, they longed for him and grieved him as though dead. In the fourth year, he showed himself again to the Thracians, and in this way, his teachings gained credibility with them. That, at least, is the account of what he supposedly did. For my own part, regarding this matter and the underground chamber, I neither reject it outright nor place too much confidence in it, though my own view is that this Salmoxis lived a good many years before Pythagoras. Whether some man named Salmoxis actually existed, or whether he is simply a local deity of the Gedi, let that question rest. These people, following this practice, once conquered by the Persians, joined the rest of the army on its march. Darius, once he and the infantry force with him reached the Ister, and once everyone had crossed over, Darius directed the Ionians to dismantle the bridge and follow him overland along with the troops from the ships. But just as the Ionians were preparing to dismantle it and carry out these orders, Kos, son of Erxander, commander of the Mytileneans, addressed Darius as follows, having first inquired whether Darius would welcome an opinion from someone willing to offer it. O king, you are about to march against a land in which nothing plowed nor any inhabited city will appear. So now let this bridge stand where it is, leaving as its guards those who built it. And if we find the Scythians and things go as we wish, there is a way back for us. And if we cannot find them, still the way back is safe for us. For I have never once worried that the Scythians might defeat us in a pitched battle, but rather that, failing to track them down, we might come to harm while roaming the country. Someone might say I argue this out of self-interest, wanting to remain behind, but I offer you, O king, the plan I judge best openly, while I myself intend to accompany you and have no wish to be left behind. Darius was delighted with this proposal, and answered him thus, Lesbian guest, when I am safely home again, be sure to appear before me, so that I may repay you for your good counsel with good deeds. Having said this, and having tied 60 knots in a leather strap, he called the tyrants of the Ionians to a meeting and said the following. Men of Ionia, let the earlier opinion given about the bridge be set aside by me. Instead, keeping this strap, do the following. As soon as you see me setting out against the Scythians, from that time begin loosening one knot each day. And if within that time I have not returned, but the days of the knots have passed for you, then sail away to your own lands. Until then, since it has been so resolved, guard the bridge, showing every eagerness for its safety and its guarding. In doing this, you will do me a great favor. Having said this, Darius pressed on ahead. Now Thrace projects toward the sea in front of the Scythian land, and as the land curves into a gulf, the Scythian land receives it, and the Ister empties into it, its mouth turned toward the east wind. I shall now go on to describe the coast from the Ister onward. This concerns the measurement of the seaward side of the Scythian land itself. From the Ister onward, this is now ancient Scythia, lying toward the midday and the south wind, as far as the city called Carcinitis. From there, along the same coastline, in country that is mountainous and juts out into the Pontus, the Tauric people occupy the land as far as the peninsula called the Rugged One. This peninsula extends down to the sea that lies toward the east wind. For Scythia has two of its borders reaching to the sea, the one toward the midday and the one toward the dawn, just as Attica does. And the Taurians occupy a portion of Scythia comparable to this, as if in Attica some other people, and not the Athenians, held the headland of Sunium, which juts out further into the sea, running from Thoricus to the deme of Anaphlistus. I say this granting that it means comparing small things to great. Such is Taurica. But for one who has not sailed along that part of Attica, I will make it plain another way. As if in Iapygia some other people, and not the Iapygians, beginning from the harbor of Brentisium, cut off a portion as far as Tarentum and occupied the headland. In naming these two cases, I am naming many similar ones to which Taurica bears resemblance. Beyond Taurica, the Scythians now occupy the country above the Taurians and the land along the Eastern Sea, both the part west of the Cimmerian Bosporus and the shore of the Maeotian Lake as far as the river Tanais, which flows out into the innermost part of this lake. Now then, from the Ister, the parts extending inland are shut off from Scythia first by the Agathiaceae, then by the Neuri, then by the Man-eaters, and last by the Black Cloaks. So then, Scythia, being as it were four-sided, with two of its sides reaching to the sea, is everywhere equal in extent, both the side running inland and the one running along the sea. From the Ister to the Borysthenes is a 10-day journey, and from the Borysthenes to Lake Maeotis another 10 days, while the distance inland from the coast to the Black Cloaks settled above the Scythians is a 20-day journey. I count each day's travel as 200 stadia. By this reckoning, the width of Scythia across would come to 4,000 stadia, and the length reaching inland the same number of stadia again. Such, then, is the size of this land. Now the Scythians, reasoning among themselves that they were not able alone to drive back Darius' army by open battle, sent messengers to their neighbors, and the kings of these peoples had already met together and were taking counsel, since a great army was advancing against them. Those who had met were the kings of the Tauri, the Agathiaceae, the Neuri, the Man-eaters, the Black Cloaks, the Gelonians, the Budini, and the Sauromatae. Of these, the Tauri follow these customs. They sacrifice to the maiden both shipwrecked men and any Greeks they take by putting out to sea and capturing in this manner. After the preliminary rites, they strike the head with a club. Some say that they then push the body down from the cliff, since the shrine sits atop a cliff, while they fix the head upon a stake. Others agree about the head, but say the body is not thrown down from the cliff, but instead buried in the ground. The Tauri themselves claim that this deity to whom they sacrifice is Iphigenia, daughter of Agamemnon. As for enemies they capture, they proceed as follows. Each man cuts off the head and takes it back to his own house, then mounts it on a tall pole and raises it well above the roofline, most often over the smoke vent. They claim these heads keep watch as guardians over the entire household. They live off plunder and warfare. The Agathiaceae are the most luxury-loving of all peoples and wear gold more than anyone. They share their women in common, so that they may count each other as brothers, and, being all kinsmen, may feel neither envy nor hatred toward each other. In their other customs, they have come close to the Thracians. The Neuri follow Scythian customs, but one generation before Darius' expedition, it befell them to abandon their whole country because of snakes. For their land brought forth many snakes on its own, and still more fell upon them from the deserts above, until under pressure, they abandoned their own territory and settled among the Budini. These people, it seems, may well practice sorcery. For both the Scythians and the Greeks settled in Scythia claim that once every year, each of the Neuri turns into a wolf for a few days before reverting back to his usual form. For my part, this claim does not convince me, yet they insist on it all the same, and they swear to it as they say it. The Man-eaters have the most savage customs of all men, observing no justice and following no law whatsoever. They are nomads, wear clothing like the Scythians, but have their own language, and are the only ones among these peoples who eat human flesh. The Black Cloaks all wear black garments, from which they also take their name, and follow Scythian customs. The Budini are a great nation and numerous, and are all strongly blue-eyed and ruddy. Among them, a city has been built of wood, called Gelonus. The wall of the city, each side of it, measures 30 stadia. It is tall and entirely of wood, and their houses too are of wood, and so are their temples. For there are indeed sanctuaries of Greek gods there, built in Greek fashion, with statues and altars and wooden shrines, and they hold triennial festivals for Dionysus and celebrate his rites. For the Gelonians were originally Greeks, who left their trading posts and settled among the Budini, and they use partly the Scythian tongue and partly the Greek. The Budini, however, do not use the same tongue as the Gelonians, nor do they share the same way of life. For the Budini, being natives of the land, are nomads and are the only people in that region who eat lice, whereas the Gelonians work the soil, eat grain, keep gardens, and are not at all like them in appearance or in coloring. Yet by the Greeks, the Budini too are called Gelonians, though this is not correct. Their whole country is thick with forests of every kind, and in the densest of the forest, there is a great lake and marsh, with reeds growing around it. In it, otters and beavers are caught, and other square-faced creatures, whose pelts are sewn onto cloaks along the border, and whose testicles are useful for treating diseases of the womb. As for the Sauromatae, this is the account given. When the Greeks fought against the Amazons, the Scythians call the Amazons Oropata, a name which means in the Greek tongue man-killers. For they call a man oir, and pata means to kill. The story goes that the Greeks, having won the battle at the Thermodon, sailed away carrying off in three ships as many of the Amazons as they had been able to take alive, and that the women, once at sea, attacked and cut down the men. But they had no knowledge of ships, nor could they use rudders or sails or oars, so once they had cut down the men were swept along by wave and wind, washing up at Cremne on Lake Meotes. Cremne sits within the territory of the Free Scythians. There the Amazons climbed down from their ships and set out on foot toward the inhabited land. Coming across the first herd of horses in their path, they seized it, and riding these horses they began plundering the Scythians' property. The Scythians could not figure out what was happening, for they recognized neither their speech nor their dress nor their nation, and were utterly at a loss as to where they had come from. They supposed them to be men of the same age, and so gave battle against them. From the battle, the Scythians took possession of the dead, and thus learned that they were women. Taking counsel, they resolved no longer to kill them in any way, but to send their own youngest men out to them, matching their numbers to those of the women, and have these men camp close to the women, mirroring whatever actions the women took. Should the women give chase, the men were not to fight but to retreat, and once the pursuit ended, they were to return and camp nearby once more. The Scythians settled on this plan because they wanted children born from these women. So the young men, once dispatched, did as they had been instructed. When the Amazons realized that they had come with no harmful intent, they let them be, and day by day the two camps drew closer to one another. Now the young men had nothing beyond their weapons and their horses, just as the Amazons had, but lived the same kind of life as they did, hunting and raiding. The Amazons, for their part, would do the following at midday. They would scatter, going off singly or in twos, spreading apart from one another to relieve themselves in private. Learning of this, the Scythians did the same thing. And one of them, finding himself alone, drew near to one of the women who was alone, and the Amazon did not push him away, but allowed him to have his way with her. Words were impossible between them, since neither understood the other's language, but she gestured with her hand for him to come the next day to the same spot and to bring another man, indicating by signs that there would be two of them, and that she herself would bring another woman. The young man, when he went back, told this to the rest. And on the next day he himself came to the spot, bringing another with him, and found the Amazon waiting there together with a second. The rest of the young men, when they learned of this, likewise won over the remaining Amazons for themselves. Afterward, joining their camps together, they lived as one, each man keeping as his wife the woman with whom he had first come together. The men were unable to learn the women's language, but the women grasped that of the men. When they understood one another, the men said the following to the Amazons. "We have parents," they said, "and we have possessions, so now let us no longer live this kind of life, but let us go back and live among our people. We will have you and no other women as our wives." To this, the women replied as follows, "We could not live together with your women, for our customs and theirs are not the same. We shoot the bow and throw the javelin and ride horses, and have never learned women's work. But your women do none of the things we have just named, and instead do women's work, staying in their wagons, never going out to the hunt or anywhere else. We could not, then, get along with them. But if you wish to have us as wives and to be thought just men, go to your parents and claim your share of the property, and then come back and let us live on our own." The young men were persuaded and did as they said. When, having claimed the share of the property that fell to them, they came back again to the Amazons, the women said to them, "Fear and dread take hold of us at the thought of how we are to live in this land, since we have deprived you of your fathers and have done much harm to your country besides. But since you think us worthy to have as wives, do this together with us. Let us rise up out of this land and go and live across the river Tanais." The young men agreed to this too, and having crossed the Tanais, they journeyed toward the rising sun for a 3 days' march from the Tanais, and for 3 days' march from Lake Meotes toward the north wind. Arriving at this place, where they now dwell, they settled there. And from that time, the women of the Sauramatti have kept to their ancient way of life, riding out on horseback to the hunt together with their men and apart from them as well, joining in war and dressed just like the men. As for speech, the Sauramatti use the Scythian tongue, though they speak it incorrectly, corrupted from the old, since the Amazons did not learn it well. This is how matters stand with them regarding marriage. No maiden is married until she has killed a man of the enemy, and some of them even die of old age before marrying, unable to fulfill the law. Now the messengers of the Scythians, having come to the assembled kings of the peoples just named, spoke, explaining that the Persian, since he has subjugated everything on the other continent, has yoked a bridge over the neck of the Bosporus and crossed over into this continent. And having crossed and subdued the Thracians, he is bridging the river Ister, wishing to bring all these lands too under his sway. So do not, sitting apart in the middle, look on while we are destroyed, but let us think as one and face the invader. Will you not do this? We, being hard-pressed, will either abandon our land or, if we stay, come to terms. For what could we suffer if you refuse to help us? For you nothing will be any lighter on that account. The Persian has come no more against us than against you, nor will it be enough for him, once he has subdued us, to hold back from you. We will give you a great proof of these words. If the Persian were campaigning against us alone, wishing to punish us for our former enslavement of him, he ought to have marched against our land alone, avoiding all the others, and so he would have shown everyone that he was marching against the Scythians and not against the others. But as it is, ever since he crossed into this continent, he has been subduing everyone who stands in his way. He already holds under him the rest of the Thracians, and in particular the Getae, who are our neighbors. When the Scythians made these declarations, the kings who had come from the several peoples deliberated, and their opinions were divided. The Gelonian, the Budinian, and the Sauramatian, agreeing together, undertook to help the Scythians. But the Agathiasian, the Nurian, the Maneater, and the Melanchlinians and Taurians answered the Scythians as follows. If you were not the first to wrong the Persians and begin the war, then the request you now make would seem to us just, and we, giving heed, would act accordingly with you. But as it is, you invaded their land without us and held sway over the Persians for as long as the God granted it to you, and now they, since that same God rouses them, are giving you the like in return. We did no wrong to these men then, nor will we now be the first to attempt any wrong against them. Yet if he comes against our land too and begins the wrong, we will not submit either. Until that happens, though, we will stay put, since in our view the Persians have marched not against us, but against those who were responsible for the wrongdoing. When the Scythians learned that this answer had been brought back, they resolved not to engage in any open pitched battle, since these peoples were not joining them as allies, but instead to withdraw and, as they withdrew, to stop up the wells they passed and fill in the springs, and to strip the grass from the earth, dividing themselves into two groups. To one of these divisions, of which Scopases was king, the Sauramatti were to attach themselves. These were to retreat, and if the Persian turned that way, to flee straight toward the river Tanais along the Meotian lake, and, when the Persian drew off, to pursue him as he advanced. This was one division of their kingdom, assigned to follow this course as has been described. The other two divisions of the kingdom, that great one which Identhiasis ruled and the third which Taxisus ruled, having come together into one, with the Gelonians and Budinians joining them too, were to withdraw a day's march ahead of the Persians, retreating and doing what had been decided. First, they were to lead them straight into the lands of those peoples who had refused their alliance, so that these two might be drawn into the war. For if they had not willingly taken up the war against the Persians, they would be forced into it against their will. After this, they were to turn back into their own land and attack, if upon deliberation it should seem good to them. Having decided this, the Scythians went out to meet the army of Darius, sending ahead the best of their horsemen as an advance guard. The wagons in which their children and all their women dwelt, and all their flocks, except for as many as were needed for provisions, these they kept back, and sent the rest on ahead together with the wagons, instructing them always to drive toward the north. This, then, was sent forward. Now the advance riders of the Scythians, when they found the Persians about 3 days' journey distant from the Ister, upon finding them, being a day's march ahead, made camp, cropping down the things growing from the earth. While the Persians, when they saw the Scythian cavalry appear, followed on their trail, the Scythians always withdrawing before them. And then, since they made for one of the divisions, the Persians pursued them toward the east and straight for the Tanais. When these had crossed the river Tanais, the Persians, crossing after them, pursued until, having passed through the land of the Sauromati, they arrived at that of the Budini. For as long as the Persians were passing through the land of the Scythians and of the Sauromati, they had nothing to damage, since the land was barren. Yet once they pushed into Budinian territory, they encountered the wooden stronghold there, the Budini having abandoned it and the fortress being emptied of everyone, and they burned it. Having done this, they continued to follow ever onward along the trail, until, having passed through this land, they arrived at the desert. This desert is inhabited by no men at all, and lies beyond the land of the Budini, being 7 days' journey in extent. Beyond the desert dwell the Thisagetti, and 4 great rivers flow out from their land, running through the country of the Meati and emptying into the lake called Meotes. These rivers bear the following names: Lycus, Oris, Tanais, Seagis. Now when Darius reached the desert, he halted his march and encamped the army on the river Oris. Having done this, he built 8 great forts, equidistant from one another, about 60 stadia apart. The ruins of these were still standing in my own time. While he was occupied with this, the Scythians who were being pursued circled around through the upper country and turned back into Scythia. When these had vanished altogether and no longer appeared before them, then Darius abandoned those forts half-finished, and himself turned back and marched westward, thinking that these were all the Scythians and that they were fleeing westward. Driving his army onward as fast as possible, when he reached Scythia, he ran into both divisions of the Scythians together, and upon encountering them, he pursued them as they withdrew a day's march ahead. And since Darius did not let up in his pursuit, the Scythians, according to their plan, kept withdrawing toward the peoples who had refused their alliance, first into the land of the Melanchthoni. When the Scythians and Persians, invading it, threw these people into confusion, the Scythians led the way into the territory of the man-eaters. When these two were thrown into confusion, they led on toward the land of the Nuri. And as these in turn were being disturbed, the Scythians went on, withdrawing, into the land of the Agathiasi. But the Agathiasi, seeing their neighbors too fleeing before the Scythians and thrown into confusion, before the Scythians could invade them, sent a herald forbidding the Scythians to set foot on their borders, warning that if they attempted to invade, they would first have to fight them. The Agathiasi, having given this warning, went out to defend their borders, intending to keep back those advancing. But the Melanchthoni, the man-eaters, and the Nuri, when the Persians invaded together with the Scythians, did not turn to resistance but, forgetting their threat, fled ever northward into the desert, thrown into confusion. The Scythians no longer went on into the land of the Agathiasi, since these had forbidden them, but led the Persians instead out of the land of the Nuri back into their own land. Since this kept happening at length without ceasing, Darius sent a horseman to the Scythian king Identhesis, saying this: "Strangest of men, why do you always flee, when it is in your power to do one of 2 other things? For if you think yourself capable of withstanding my power, you should stand your ground and cease your wandering and fight. But if you acknowledge that you are weaker, then you too, ceasing your flight, should come and hold parley with your master, bringing gifts of earth and water." To this, the Scythian king Identhesis replied as follows: "This is how matters stand with me, Persian. I have never yet fled from any man out of fear, neither before nor now do I flee from you, nor am I doing anything new now that I did not also do in time of peace. As for why I do not fight you at once, I will explain this too. We have neither cities nor cultivated land, out of fear for which, lest it be captured or ravaged, we would join battle with you the sooner. But if it is altogether necessary to come to this quickly, we do happen to have ancestral tombs. Come, find these and try to disturb them, and then you will know whether we will fight you for the tombs or whether we will not fight. Until then, unless we think it good, we will not engage you. So much, then, be said concerning battle. As for masters, the only ones I recognize are Zeus, from whom I am descended, and Hestia, queen of the Scythians. As for you, in place of gifts of earth and water, I will send such gifts as are fitting for you to receive, and in return for your claiming to be my master, I bid you weep." This is the Scythian saying. So the herald departed to report this to Darius, and the Scythian kings, hearing the word slavery, were filled with anger. As for the division that had been sent with the Sauromati, which Scopasis led, they sent word to the Ionians who were guarding the bridge over the Ister, asking them to come to a conference. Those who were left behind decided no longer to wander about, but to attack the Persians each time they went out to gather food. So by watching for Darius's men gathering food, they did what had been planned. The Scythian cavalry always routed the Persian cavalry, and the Persian horsemen, fleeing, fell back on their infantry, and the infantry would come to their aid. But the Scythians, having driven back the cavalry, would themselves turn back for fear of the infantry. The Scythians also made similar attacks by night. Now the thing that helped the Persians and worked against the Scythians when they attacked Darius's camp, I will tell a very strange fact, was the braying of the donkeys and the appearance of the mules. For neither donkey nor mule is found in the land of Scythia, as I have already shown, and there is no donkey or mule anywhere in the whole Scythian country because of the cold. So when the donkeys brayed, they threw the Scythian cavalry into confusion. Often, as they were riding against the Persians, as soon as the horses heard the sound of the donkeys, they would panic and wheel about and be seized with wonder, pricking up their ears, since they had never before heard such a sound nor seen such a creature. This, then, had only a small effect on the course of the war. Now the Scythians, whenever they saw the Persians thrown into confusion, would act so that the Persians would stay longer in Scythia, and staying, would suffer distress from lacking everything. They did as follows. Whenever they left some of their own flocks behind with the herdsmen, they themselves would ride off to another place. The Persians would come upon the flocks, seize them, and after seizing them would grow proud of what they had done. This happened many times, until finally Darius was at a loss, and the Scythian kings, learning of this, sent a herald bearing gifts to Darius: a bird, a mouse, a frog, and 5 arrows. The Persians asked the man bringing the gifts what the meaning of what was given might be. He said he had been instructed to say nothing else except to deliver them and depart as quickly as possible, but he told the Persians themselves, if they were wise, to figure out what the gifts meant to say. Having heard this, the Persians deliberated. Now Darius's opinion was that the Scythians were surrendering to him themselves, and earth and water, reasoning it out as follows: that a mouse is born in the earth and eats the same crop as a man, a frog lives in water, a bird resembles a horse more than anything, and the arrows meant that they were surrendering their own might. This was the opinion Darius put forward. But opposed to this opinion was that of Gobryas, one of the 7 men who had done away with the Magus, who guessed the gifts meant: unless you Persians become birds and fly up into the sky, burrow into the earth as mice, or leap into the marshes as frogs, you will not return home again, but will be struck down by these arrows. So the Persians interpreted the gifts in these 2 ways. Meanwhile, the 1 division of the Scythians that had earlier been assigned to guard by Lake Meotes, and was now to go to the Ionians at the Ister to hold a conference, when it arrived at the bridge, said the following: "Men of Ionia, we have come bringing you freedom, if indeed you are willing to listen. For we understand that Darius ordered you to guard the bridge for only 60 days, and if he did not arrive within that time, to depart for your own country. Now if you do this, you will be blameless both before him and before us. Stay the appointed days, and after that depart." These, then, when the Ionians had promised to do this, hurried back as quickly as possible. After the gifts had come to Darius, the Scythians who remained drew up against the Persians in infantry and cavalry, as if to give battle. But as the Scythians stood in formation, a hare darted through their midst. As each of them saw the hare, they gave chase to it. When the Scythians fell into confusion and raised a shout, Darius asked about the uproar among his opponents, and learning that they were chasing the hare, he said to those he was accustomed to address on other matters as well: "These men hold us in great contempt, and it now seems to me that Gobryas spoke rightly about the Scythian gifts. Since I too now think as he does, we need good counsel, so that our return may be safe." To this Gobryas said, "O king, I already knew fairly well from report the helplessness of these men, but having come here I have learned it far better still, seeing them mocking us. Now it seems to me that as soon as night falls, we should light the fires as we are accustomed to do at other times too, deceive the weakest of our soldiers into thinking they will be left to endure hardship, tie up all the donkeys, and depart, before the Scythians either rush straight to the Ister to break the bridge, or the Ionians decide on something that could destroy us. This was Gobryas's advice. And afterward night came, and Darius followed this plan. The exhausted men, and those whose loss would matter least, along with all the donkeys tied up, he left behind there in the camp. He left the donkeys and the weak of the army for this reason, so that the donkeys would make noise, and the men were left behind because of their weakness, but the pretext given was, of course, that he himself, with the sound part of the army, intended to attack the Scythians, while these men were to guard the camp for that time. Having given these instructions to those left behind, Darius lit the fires and hurried as fast as possible toward the Ister. The donkeys, left alone without the crowd, brayed all the more loudly, and the Scythians, hearing the donkeys, fully believed that the Persians were still in place. When day came, those left behind, realizing they had been betrayed by Darius, stretched out their hands to the Scythians and told them what had happened. When the Scythians heard this, they gathered together as quickly as possible, the two divisions of the Scythians and the one, along with the Sauromati, the Budini, and the Geloni, and pursued the Persians straight toward the Ister. Since the Persian army was mostly infantry and did not know the roads, since the roads had not been marked out, while the Scythian force was cavalry and knew the shortcuts of the route, they missed each other, and the Scythians arrived at the bridge long before the Persians. Finding that the Persians had not yet come, they spoke to the Ionians who were stationed in their ships. "Men of Ionia, the number of days appointed to you has run out, and you are not acting rightly by still remaining. But since before you stayed out of fear, now break the crossing and depart quickly, rejoicing in your freedom and giving thanks to the gods and to the Scythians. As for the man who was formerly your master, we will deal with him in such a way that he will never again campaign against any people." At this the Ionians took counsel. Milchiades the Athenian, general and tyrant of the Chersonesites on the Hellespont, was of the opinion that they should obey the Scythians and free Ionia. But Hystiaeus of Miletus was opposed to this, saying that at present each of them ruled his city because of Darius, and that if Darius's power were overthrown, neither would he himself be able to rule the Milesians, nor would anyone else be able to rule anywhere else. For each of the cities would want to be governed as a democracy rather than ruled by a tyrant. When Hystiaeus put forward this opinion, all of them immediately turned to this view, though before they had favored that of Milchiades. Those who cast their votes and were men of standing with the king were these: of the Hellespontine tyrants, Daphnis of Abydos, Hippoclus of Lampsacus, Hierophantus of Parium, Metrodorus of Proconnesus, Aristagoras of Cyzicus, and Ariston of Byzantium. These were the men from the Hellespont. From Ionia there were Strates of Chios, Eases of Samos, Laodamas of Phocaea, and Hystiaeus of Miletus, whose opinion had been set forth in opposition to that of Milchiades. Of the Aeolians, the only man of note present was Aristagoras of Syme. When these men adopted Hystiaeus's opinion, they resolved to add to it the following actions and words. They would break down the part of the bridge that faced the Scythians, breaking it down as far as an arrow's shot could reach, so that they would seem to be doing something while doing nothing, and so that the Scythians, even by force and by their own wish, would not attempt crossing the Ister at the bridge. And while breaking that part of the bridge facing Scythia, they would say that they would do everything that pleased the Scythians. This they added to their plan. After that, Hystiaeus, speaking on behalf of them all, answered as follows: "Men of Scythia, you have come bringing good news, and at the right time you are urging haste, and both what comes from you is guiding us well and what comes from us serves you fittingly. For as you see, we are breaking the crossing, and we shall show every eagerness, wishing to be free. But while we are breaking this, it is the time for you to seek out those men, and having found them, to avenge both us and yourselves as befits them." The Scythians, believing a second time that the Ionians spoke the truth, turned back to search for the Persians and missed the whole of their route. The Scythians themselves were the cause of this, having destroyed the horse pastures in that region and filled in the water sources. For if they had left this undone, finding the Persians, if they so wished, would have proved an easy matter for them. But as it was, the very thing they thought was their best plan was what made them fail. Now the Scythians, in the part of their own country where there was fodder for the horses and water, went through that region searching for their enemies, thinking that they too were making their escape through such places. But the Persians, following their earlier they went on, keeping to the track they themselves had made, and so with difficulty found the crossing. Having arrived at night to find the bridge dismantled, they fell into utter dread that the Ionians had abandoned them. Now there was with Darius an Egyptian man with the loudest voice of anyone. This man Darius ordered to stand on the bank of the Ister and call for Hishias the Milesian. He did this, and Hishias, hearing the very first call, brought up all the ships to ferry the army across and rejoin the bridge. So the Persians escaped in this way, while the Scythians, searching, missed the Persians a second time, and for this reason they judged the Ionians, being free men, to be the basest and most unmanly of all people. But on the other hand, speaking of them as though they were slaves, they say they are slaves fond of their masters and unlikely to run off. This much has been thrown at the Ionians by the Scythians. Darius journeyed through Thrace and reached Sestos, in the Chersonese. From there he himself crossed by ship to Asia, but he left behind as general in Europe Megabazus, a Persian man, to whom Darius had once given an honor, having spoken this saying among the Persians. When Darius was about to eat pomegranates, as soon as he opened the first of them, his brother Artabanus asked him what he would wish to have in such abundance as there were seeds in the pomegranate. Darius said he would wish to have that many megabazuses in number rather than have Greece subject to him. By saying this among the Persians, he honored him, and now he left him behind as general in charge of his own army, 80,000 strong. This Megabazus, by saying the following thing, left behind an immortal memory among the people of the Hellespont. Being in Byzantium, he learned that the Chalcedonians had founded their land 17 years before the Byzantines, and on learning this, he said that the Chalcedonians must have been blind at that time, for they would not have chosen the uglier site when the finer one was available, unless they were blind. So this Megabazus, left behind then as general in the land of the Hellespont, was subduing those who did not side with the Medes. This is what he was doing. At the same time, another great expedition of an army was being mounted against Libya, for a reason which I will relate after first telling the following in advance. Of the sons of the crew of the Argo, their children, driven out by the Pelasgians from Broron who had carried off the women of Athens, were driven out by them from Lemnos and sailed off to Laestymon, and settling on Mount Taygetus they kindled a fire. The Lacedaemonians, seeing it, sent a messenger to find out who they were and from where. And to the messenger's questioning they said that they were Minyans, children of the heroes who had sailed on the Argo, who had put in at Lemnos and begotten them there. The Lacedaemonians, having heard the account of the lineage of the Minyans, sent a second time and asked what they wanted, coming into the land and lighting a fire. They said that, having been cast out by the Pelasgians, they had come to their fathers, for it was most just that this should happen so. And they asked to dwell together with them, sharing in honors and receiving a portion of the land. It seemed good to the Lacedaemonians to receive the Minyans on whatever terms they themselves wished. What most drove them to do this was that the sons of Tyndarus had sailed on the Argo. Once they had received the Minyans, they allotted them a share of land and divided them up among the tribes. They at once contracted marriages and gave in marriage the women they had brought from Lemnos to others. Not much time had passed before the Minyans grew arrogant, laying claim to the kingship and doing other things not lawful. So it seemed good to the Lacedaemonians to kill them, and seizing them they threw them into prison. Now the Lacedaemonians kill those whom they kill by night, never by day. When they were about to put them to death, the wives of the Minyans, being citizens and daughters of the leading Spartiates, begged permission to go into the prison and speak, each with her own husband. The guards let them in, thinking no trick would come of it. But when they had entered, they did as follows. They gave over to the men all the clothing they were wearing and themselves took that of the men, and the Minyans, putting on the women's clothing, went out as though they were women. Escaping by this trick, they settled again on Mount Taygetus. At this same time Theras, son of Autesian, son of Tisamnus, son of Thersander, son of Polynices, was setting out from Laestymon to found a colony. This Theras was by lineage a Cadmean, the brother of the mother of the sons of Aristodemus, Eurysthenes, and Procles. While these children were still infants, Theras held the kingship at Sparta as guardian. But when his nephews grew up and took over the rule, then Theras, thinking it terrible to be ruled by others once he had tasted rule, said he would not remain in Laestymon, but would sail away to his kinsmen. There were, on the island now called Thera, but formerly called Callista, the same island, descendants of Membliorus son of Poseils, a Phoenician man. For Cadmus son of Agenor, seeking Europa, had put in at what is now called Thera. And having put in, whether the land pleased him or he wished to do this for some other reason, he left on this island, among other Phoenicians, Membliorus of his own kinsmen. These people inhabited the island called Callista for generations, before Theras came from Laestemon, 8 men in all. Against these Theras set out with a body of men drawn from the tribes, to settle together with them, in no way to drive them out, but rather to make them fully his own. And when the minions, having escaped from the prison, had settled on Mount Taygetus, and the Lacedaemonians were deliberating on destroying them, Theras begged that no killing take place, and he himself undertook to lead them out of the country. The Lacedaemonians agreeing to this proposal, he sailed with 3 30-oared ships to the descendants of Membliorus, not taking all the minions, but only a few. Most of them turned instead against the Peroridae and the Cocones, and driving these out of their country, divided themselves into 6 groups, and then founded the following cities among them: Leprium, Macistus, Phrixi, Piagus, Epium, Nudium. Most of these, in my own time, were destroyed by the Eleans. The island was named Thera after its founder. His son, for he said he would not sail with him, so his father said he would leave him behind like a sheep among wolves. Because of this saying, the young man came to be called Oelicus, and somehow this name prevailed. From Oelicus was born Aegeus, after whom the Aegidae are called, a great tribe in Sparta. The men of this tribe, for their children did not survive, established, on the advice of an oracle, a shrine of the furies of Laius and Oedipus. And after this, the children born to these men in Thera also survived in the same way. Up to this point in the story, the Lacedaemonians and the Thereans agree, but from this point on only the Thereans tell it as follows. Grinnus, son of Isaeneus, a descendant of this Theras and king of the island of Thera, arrived at Delphi bringing a hecatomb from his city. And there followed him also other citizens, and in particular Battus son of Polymnestus, by lineage a Euphemid of the Minyans. When Grinnus, king of the Thereans, consulted the oracle about other matters, the Pythia gave an oracle to found a city in Libya. He replied, saying, "I, Lord, am already too old and heavy to be stirred. Bid one of these younger men do this." While saying this, he gestured toward Battus. That was all that was said then. Afterward, when they had returned home, they paid no heed to the oracle, neither knowing where in the world Libya was, nor daring to send out a colony to so uncertain a thing. But 7 years after this, it did not rain on Thera, during which all the trees on the island but one withered away. When the Thereans consulted the oracle, the Pythia again urged the colony to Libya. Since they had no remedy for their trouble, they sent to Crete messengers to inquire whether any Cretan or resident alien there had ever been to Libya. Wandering about the island, these men came also to the city of Itanis, and there they met a purple fisher named Corobius, who said winds had swept him off course to Libya, and from there to the island of Plataea. Persuading him with pay, they brought him to Thera, and from Thera scouts sailed out, few men at first. With Corobius guiding them to this island of Plataea, they left Corobius there, leaving behind provisions for a certain number of months, while they themselves sailed as quickly as possible to report to the Thereans about the island. But when these men were away longer than the agreed time, Corobius ran out of everything. And after this, a Samian ship, whose captain was Callias, sailing for Egypt, was carried off course to this Plataea. And the Samians, learning the whole story from Corobius, provided him a year's worth of food. Setting out from the island, eager to reach Egypt, they sailed on, driven off course by an easterly wind. And since the wind did not let up, they went through the Pillars of Heracles and arrived at Tardesus, guided by divine providence. This trading port was at that time untouched, so that these men, on returning home, made the greatest profit from their cargo of all the Greeks of whom we have accurate knowledge, except for Sostratus son of Laodamas and Aegenetan, for with him no other could vie. The Samians, taking out a tenth of their profits, 6 talents worth, had a bronze vessel made in the manner of an argolic mixing bowl. Around it griffins' heads project in a row, they are. And they dedicated in the harem 3 colossal bronze statues, 7 cubits tall, each resting on its knees as a base. It was from this deed that great friendship first arose between the people of Cyrene and Thera on one side and the Samians on the other. As for the Thurans, once they had left Corobius on the island and come back to Thera, they reported that a colony had been established for them on an island off Libya. The Thurans then decided to send men chosen by lot, brother from brother, and from all the districts, which numbered 7, and that their leader and king should be Battus. So they fitted out 2 50-oared ships for Plataea. This much the Thurans say. The rest of the story the Thurans and Cyrenians no longer agree on. For the Cyrenians do not at all agree with the Thurans about Battus. They tell it this way. There is in Crete a city called Oxus, where there was a king named Eterchus, who, having a motherless daughter named Phronyme, married another woman on her account. This woman, once brought into the household, made sure to act the stepmother toward Phronyme both in name and in deed, causing her trouble and contriving everything against her, and finally, charging her with wantonness, she persuaded her husband to deal with her accordingly. And he, persuaded by his wife, contrived an unholy deed against his daughter. For there was a Thurian man, a merchant, named Themison, living in Oxus. Eterchus took him in as a guest friend and made him swear that he would do for him whatever he asked. When he had sworn the oath, Eterchus led out his own daughter and handed her over, ordering him to take her away and drown her in the sea. But Themison, indignant at having been tricked by the oath, broke off the guest friendship and did the following instead. He took the girl and put out to sea. Once he was on the open water, in order to fulfill the letter of his oath to Eterchus, he bound her with cords, lowered her into the sea, then hauled her back up, and so arrived at Thera. From there Polymnestus, a man of repute among the Thurans, took Phronyme and kept her as a concubine. In time there was born to him a son who was weak-voiced and had a stammer, and he was named Battus, as the Thurans and Cyrenians say, though I myself think it was something else. He was renamed Battus after he arrived in Libya, taking the name from the oracle given him at Delphi, and from the honor he received there. Since the Libyans use the word battos for a king, I think it was for this reason that the Pythia, in prophesying, addressed him in the Libyan tongue, knowing that he would be king in Libya. Once he had grown to manhood, he went to Delphi about his voice, and when he put his question, the Pythia gave him this response. Battus, you have come about your voice. But Lord Phoebus Apollo sends you to Libya, rich in flocks, to found a colony, as if she had said in the Greek tongue, O king, you have come about your voice. And he answered her thus, Lord, I came to you to consult about my voice, but you tell me other things impossible to do, bidding me colonize Libya, with what power, with what hand? Saying this, he did not persuade her to give him a different oracle, and when she prophesied the same things to him as before, he went off, leaving her in the middle of it, and returned to Thera. After this, misfortune befell both him and the other Thurans, one calamity after another. Not understanding the cause of these disasters, the Thurans sent to Delphi about the troubles that beset them. The Pythia responded that they would fare better if they helped Battus found Cyrene in Libya. After this, the Thurans sent out Battus with 2 50-oared ships. These men sailed to Libya, but not knowing what else to do, they turned back and sailed for Thera. But the Thurans pelted them as they came into land and would not let them touch shore, ordering them to sail back. Forced to do so, they sailed back and settled an island lying off Libya, whose name, as was said before, is Plataea. This island is said to be equal in size to the present city of Cyrene. They lived there for 2 years, but since nothing went well for them, they left one man behind and all the rest sailed to Delphi, and upon reaching the oracle they questioned it, telling it that they were dwelling in Libya, but that things were no better for them living there than before. To this the Pythia gave them this response, If you know rich in flocks Libya better than I who have been there, though you have not been there yourself, greatly do I marvel at your wisdom. Hearing this, Battus and his men sailed back, for the god was not going to release them from the colony until they had actually reached Libya itself. Arriving at the island and taking up the man they had left behind, they found it a place on the Libyan mainland itself, opposite the island, whose name was Azyrus. This place is enclosed on both sides by the most beautiful wooded glens, and a river flows along one side of it. They lived in this place for 6 years, but by the 7th year the Libyans had talked them into leaving, promising to lead them to a better place. So the Libyans made them get up and led them away from there toward the west, and timing the journey by hours of the day, they led the Greeks past the most beautiful of all the regions by night, so that they would not see it. This place is called Erasa. Having brought them to a spring said to belong to Apollo, they said, "Men of Greece, here it is fitting for you to live, for here the sky is pierced." Now, during the lifetime of Battus the founder, who ruled for 40 years, and of his son Arcesilaus, who ruled for 16 years, the Cyrenians continued to live there in the same numbers as those first sent out to found it. Yet in the reign of the third king, Battus called the Fortunate, the Pythia by her oracle stirred up all the Greeks to set sail and settle in Libya together with the Cyrenians, for the Cyrenians themselves were inviting them, offering a share in the land. And this was the oracle she gave. "Whoever comes later to lovely Libya, when the land has already been divided up, will one day, I say, have cause to regret it." A great crowd gathered at Cyrene, and the Libyans round about, along with their king, whose name was Adocrine, finding much of their land cut away and being treated with contempt by the Cyrenians, sent to Egypt and surrendered themselves to Apries, king of Egypt. He gathered a large army of Egyptians and sent it against Cyrene. The Cyrenians marched out to the place called Erasa, to the spring called the Ste, and joined battle with the Egyptians and won the engagement. For the Egyptians, never before having had experience of Greeks and underestimating them, were so utterly destroyed that only a few of them made it back to Egypt. Because of this, and holding other grievances against him, the Egyptians revolted from Apries. This Battus had a son, Arcesilaus, who, when he became king, first fell into strife with his own brothers, until they left him and went off to another part of Libya, and, on their own initiative, founded the city that was then, and still is, called Barca. As they founded it, they also persuaded the Libyans there to revolt from the Cyrenians. Afterward, Arcesilaus made war on those same Libyans who had both received his brothers and revolted along with them, and the Libyans, in fear of him, fled to the Libyans of the east. Arcesilaus pursued them as they fled, until he came to Leucon in Libya, and there, as he was pursuing them, the Libyans resolved to attack him. Joining battle, they defeated the Cyrenians so decisively that 7,000 Cyrenian hoplites fell there. After this disaster, Arcesilaus, who was ill and had taken a drug, was strangled by his brother Halearchus, and Halearchus was killed by treachery by Arcesilaus's own wife, whose name was Eryxo. Arcesilaus's kingship was inherited by his son Battus, who was lame and not sound of foot. The Cyrenians, in the face of the disaster that had befallen them, sent to Delphi to ask by what arrangement they might best establish their state. The Pythia bade them bring a reformer from Mantinea in Arcadia. The Cyrenians then asked, and the Mantineans gave them a man held in highest regard among their citizens, named Demonax. This man, when he arrived in Cyrene and had learned all the particulars, first divided them into three tribes, arranging them as follows. He made one division of the Thurians and the surrounding peoples, a second combining Peloponnesians and Cretans, and a third comprising all the islanders. Then, having set aside sacred estates and priesthoods for King Battus, he put everything else that the kings had previously held into the common possession of the people. So under this Battus things continued in this state, but under his son Arcesilaus much turmoil arose over the royal privileges. For Arcesilaus, son of the lame Battus and Pheretime, said he would not put up with things as Demonax the Mantinean had arranged them, but demanded back the privileges of his ancestors. Rising up in faction over this, he was defeated and fled to Samos, while his mother fled to Salamis in Cyprus. At that time, Salamis was ruled by Evelthon, who dedicated at Delphi the censer worth seeing, which lies in the treasury of the Corinthians. Coming to him, Pheretime asked for an army that would restore them to Cyrene. But Evelthon offered her anything rather than an army, and she, accepting each gift as it was given, would say it too was fine, but finer still would be for him to give her, as she asked, an army. This she said after every gift he gave her, until finally Evelthon sent her, as a last gift, a golden spindle and distaff, with wool attached to it as well. When Pheretime again repeated the same request, Evelthon said that such things were fit gifts for women, not an army.